Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Lisa Z. Siegel. She's a professor of history at DePaul University of Chicago, and we're talking about her new book, The People's Porn, A History of Handmade Pornography in America. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
This is a complicated book, and we were talking about this off mic. There's a lot of these subjects and chapters that could honestly be standalone books because they deal with very different subjects, very different ways in which these objects were used or utilized. Was it hard to put this all together and even find these objects?
It was hard. I think I've been working on this for 10, 11 years at this point.
Wow.
So over time, I just kept finding about more and new types of pornography, handmade pornography. And even now when I give an interview, whenever I do, somebody comes up to me and tells me about something that I had no idea about. And I'm like, no, I want this in the book.
Well, it takes many forms. And that's one of the things that's sort of interesting is that it's the surrounding, how these objects were utilized within those cultures varies wildly. Like prison porn, obviously, was venting pent-up sexuality, but also used for masturbation.
Yeah.
But some of these folk objects just sort of seem like jokes. And you would like hand one of these things and open the coffin, and the erect penis would pop out, and you'd have a good laugh at that. However, the one thing I wasn't sure about was erotic scrimshaw.
I like, love the erotic scrimshaw.
It's so, first of all,
like Moby Dick.
So to speak.
Yeah.
But it's, first of all, it's very beautifully done, a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about erotic scrimshaw. Are there a lot of examples?
No. I mean, there are yes and no. So there's this big controversy about fake erotic scrimshaw. There was actually a museum exhibit that it was not well authenticated, and they ended up having fake erotic scrimshaw, because real scrimshaw purists will say that scrimshaw has to have been made on a boat during the age of sail, rather than made retrospectively, because, you know, people would have whale bones or teeth or like in their garage, and then that you could go and etch those. Like today, you could go to your garage, etch an erotic piece, but that wouldn't be scrimshaw. So there's fake scrimshaw.
I love the fact that there's rules to this, though.
There's very careful rules. So there's fake scrimshaw, erotic scrimshaw rolling around in the world, but there is also some real erotic scrimshaw. And you need some really careful authenticators in order to tell the difference.
Well, while we're talking about this, and I want to talk about some of the general themes in this book. People are probably listening to it. So, like, why are these objects important? What are these objects? These objects are sort of portals into what?
They're portals into the kinds of ways that people could conceptualize sexuality in the past, before you have the internet, before you have mass magazines, and mass access to pornography. So they let us see how people conceptualized sexuality before the consumer market intervened.
Now, you write that very few examples, when we're talking about American pornography, remain from the 19th century. Why is that?
That's because of Comstock and a bunch of anti-pornography activists in the 19th century.
Talk about who Comstock was.
Now, Anthony Comstock, he was the head of the Society for the Suppression of Vice, and then he became postal inspector for the U.S. government. And he kept, he really wanted to maintain purity, particularly amongst children, and particularly middle-class children. And so he inspected materials which were going through the post, which is how most things were being sold at that moment, and anything having to do with sexuality, he would seize, he would prosecute the people who were shipping it, he would burn the objects. So he was very, very proud that he burned things in the tonnage. It wasn't like the individual piece, it was by the ton. And then he proudly talked about the number of people who he drove to suicide.
Oh, my God.
Which were in the dozens, yeah.
Jeez. But in the 20th century, especially in the mid to later 20th century, Lisa, in the 20th century, especially mid to later part of the 20th century, at least in the Kinsey Institute, there's a huge collection of objects and, yeah, and writing. And talk to me about how he collected those.
So he collected them from a variety of different ways. He was a real people person. So everybody who would, he would meet, he would do an interview with for his books, and he would also ask them about materials, his, the sexual artifacts that they might have come across. And so this goes to police, to wardens, to collectors, and he encouraged people to either sell him objects or to donate objects to the Kinsey. And the thing that's wonderful about his collection is that he was a bit of a magpie. Anything that he came across, he saw value in. Even if he didn't know how to use it personally, he thought that it should be saved. So there's things there that you like, erotic retouchings of magazines,
right,
where someone would draw a breast on a
You have examples of this
person.
In the book.
Yeah, I do. And we've all come across them, like in an airline magazine,
yep,
where someone would draw eyeglasses or boobs on someone. But he collected them rather than throwing them away. He was like, there's a value here. And so he would keep it and put it into his collections. And now you can go and see this sort of time capsule of the way people conceptualize sex at that moment.
We talk about altering magazines. Muscle magazines, these sort of physique magazines where people altered them with erect penises and so forth, that ended up being very important for the gay community at the time.
Yes. If you couldn't buy porn, you could make your own porn.
But they would also circulate, right? You would hand it to somebody else? Yep.
Yeah, you would go and hand it one to another, or you would make, you would collage them, you would add a separate story, create a typescript that you would then send along or sell. So it ends up being this hand-to-hand community formed around these handmade objects.
Now, you describe these books as neither historian nor art historian. Neither groups have embraced these objects, and especially some of these sort of handmade, hand-carved objects, like we talked about the scrimshaw, but there's canes and all sorts of stuff. What is the story with these objects? Are they just sort of waifs that are abandoned and nobody's looking after them?
Well, historians certainly aren't looking after them.
They'd rather not know about the history of sexuality.
No. They just, I mean, there's very few historians of pornography out there, period.
Yep.
And we have such a big job trying to understand how the trade has changed over time that There aren't really great historians of pornographic film. So these little objects just don't really have a home. Art historians have done a better job with some of the big names in outsider art or folk art.
Yep.
But these, you know, they sort of fall by the wayside, and there isn't like a big collection somewhere. No one's really pulled them together. So there hasn't been a call to make sense of them.
Is that part of the function of your book, though, is at least to start discussing them so people can have these conversations?
Absolutely. I'm hoping that people, you know, every time I give an interview, someone comes up and hands me something new or tells me about something. And I'm hoping that some industrious young graduate student is like, yes, I want to do book two. She didn't do a good job. I want to do a much better job. And that there will be a group of people who are making sense of these objects.
You must have an amazing lecture. Here, take these.
Yeah, actually, people keep shipping me things.
Great.
And I'm like, okay, I'll put them in my collection. You know, they're worried that they'll die and their families will find them.
Oh, okay, that one. Yeah, I'm going in for surgery. I don't want people to find my private collection. I'll send it to Lisa,
right. Or they're just going to be sold off at a swap meet, and they're more important than that. Make sense of it, Lisa. Find a home for it.
What do we know about these older objects, especially from the 19th century or right at the turn of the century? What about the provenance of these objects? What do we know about them?
We know virtually nothing about the provenance of the objects. They have no makers, they have no owners, they have no place. They just sort of shuffle along either hand to hand or through the sort of swap meet trade. And it's only by seeing lots of them that you can start seeing that there's a pattern rather than an individual person made something. You know, you see one set of erotic potholders, and you're
right,
wow, somebody came up with this idea. And then you see 10 or 15, and you're like, no, there must have been patterns circulating. I always think it's like home ec gone wild.
And the quality of the objects, I guess the visual quality of the objects, varies wildly.
Yeah.
Especially when you get to these sort of older carved wooden objects, some of them are just really very primitive looking.
Yes, and some of them are absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we don't know anything about the people that carved these. They didn't put their initials on them.
No.
Okay.
No. But some of them are really beautiful. You can't tell. There's a little ring, a scrimshaw ring.
Oh, the one that's in the book?
That's in the book.
It's beautiful.
But if you magnify the picture and you get closer and closer, there's individual little pubic hairs. It is so, there's just something so touching about somebody making this tiny little ring that's supposed to go on your hand and then carving it smaller and smaller.
As you write in the book, these present an unmediated view of personal sexual desire. And it's really true. I mean, you think about the people that are carving these, and somehow we all knee-jerk sort of think of them in one way. But these could be anybody that are doing mm-hmm. this. And they are amazing objects. Like when you get to those canes and stuff like that, and even coins, some people like spent an incredible time altering these silver dollars so that they had sexual content to them on the front. I actually started thinking about the work it would take to do that. And mm-hmm. it's amazing that people were doing that.
Yes, it is. And especially since currency was sometimes very hard to come by, people didn't have a lot of cash to be altering them, and yet they would. And then I always think, what were they doing? Were they just jiggling them in their pockets, or did they send them back into circulation and laugh knowing that these would go forward and circulate as currency?
Is it possible that, especially in the coins, that it was some kind of political statement against the government?
In some cases, it seems to be.
Okay, okay.
But in other cases, it seems like just a big belly laugh. and so you have to read each one against the place that it circulated. And since we don't know a lot about provenance, we might not be able to make those claims.
Do we assume that all the makers are male?
We would assume that all the makers are male.
At least up until the, like, say, 1950s, when the invention of Polaroids.
Well, we would, except for there are these female-made objects. When we start in the 20th century to be able to understand provenance, we can be like, no, a woman made this. So when you start getting like the hook rugs or the feminist folk art in the 20th century, women were making those. So maybe women were making earlier objects as well, but we just don't know.
Now, we were talking about physical objects. People would also create sort of homemade texts and pamphlets. Can you talk about that? And specifically, I'm thinking about A Pretty Girl's Companion and Guide to Love's Sweetest Delight, which is, and the artwork in it was wild.
I think that started my project, and I didn't realize that. I saw that when I was doing my dissertation research somewhere between 20 and 30 years ago, and I never knew what to do with it. What can you do with a document that has no maker, no time, no place? We don't know where it circulated, and it's this amazing little handmade pamphlet. It is hand-lined and hand-lettered. And it starts off, and it looks like any other, like, little handmade pamphlet. It could be talking about daisies or roses. It could be talking about, you know, how to embroider something. But instead, you start opening it, and it just gets more and more obscene. And I was always thinking, what could I do with this document? And it took years for me to start thinking about the fact that this document let me see sexuality before industrialization, before people could access the text they wanted to see. He made the text he wanted to see. And I say he because it starts off being like a girl-to-girl pamphlet, and
yeah.
It becomes this guy to guy pamphlet or guy to how to encourage young girls to have sex. It's a very strange document.
You also make, there's so many points that you make in this book that are actually generally important. One of the things that people assume is that the commercialization of porn is making billions of dollars, and that ended people making their own. But what you found out is it just inspired people to make more of their own personal pornography.
Right. Well, I found out two things. Number one, any facts or figures that you get about the porn trade are suspect. We don't know how much money people are making off of porn. Mm-hmm. And the more you look into the figures, the more you realize that they have very shaky foundations. So everybody loves to quote, you know, these billions of dollars. And then you follow them back, and it goes through an editorial, and it goes through an interview, and a lot of them come back to this interview of someone who was working in the trade and who just came up with a quote. You're like, this is the foundation for the billions of dollars? A dude? So that's one thing that I found out. And then the question of whether the industrialization of pornography sort of swamps homemade and handmade materials, it's not true. People continue to make their own objects. I think that there's something very moving about the process of making. People want to conceptualize sex for themselves,
right.
And they're on the search for authenticity.
Well, as you're right, and I love this. Most people wouldn't think about this, but a tremendous boost to the cottage industry of making your own started with Polaroids. And not to state the obvious, but talk about the obvious, why obviously that's true.
Well, people wanted to be able to document themselves. They wanted to see how they looked. They wanted to capture their excitement. And Polaroids let them do that without having to have the film processed. If you had the film stock processed, you could get arrested. People would be looking at it. So Polaroids let people communicate about themselves with no intervention of the police or with the pharmacist or with the film company. It was just you documenting your own sex.
From that point on, technology really takes a huge role in this story.
Yes, it does.
Because there's homemade video, then there's the internet, and then all of a sudden you're marketing homemade porn. And
yes.
This is where it gets into really interesting issues of consumer culture.
Yes. You know, amateur is its own genre.
Yeah.
And it's very strange because there are all these, like, visual markers that it's amateur porn. But if you're going and reading how to create amateur porn, is it really amateur porn then?
Right. Exactly. Now, some of the stuff you have in your book I consider really still problematic. And I want to talk one example. It's Henry Darger, who lived 1892 to 1973. Most people probably don't know that story. Can you talk about it?
Henry Darger, he's a beautiful artist.
I'm pretty broad-minded, Lisa. I think I find the work problematic.
Right.
Okay, so, let's talk about his story first before we get into a discussion.
Okay. He was orphaned quite young. His mom died in childbirth. His father was an impoverished tailor. He was sent to school, and he apparently didn't fit in very well. Eventually, he was sent off because he didn't fit in with society. He was sent to the Home for Feeble-Minded Children. Downstate, and it was attached to an all-male prison. His father died, and he hated being there, and eventually he made his way back to Chicago. He hitched a train and came back to Chicago, and then he worked in social services for the Catholic community, worked as a janitor and a bandage roller and things like that. He was very poor. He worked his whole life, and he created these artworks, which include manuscripts that he typed himself and illustrations for these stories, these huge stories that he told over thousands and thousands of pages. One of them, the most famous one, is The Realms of the Unreal, which is the story of the seven Vivian sisters and their fight against child slavery. It hasn't been published as a book. It's this imaginative document that he created and then illustrated.
How did he illustrate them? He used cutouts from paper dolls, from magazines, and all sorts of stuff.
Yes, from magazines, paper dolls, newspapers, coloring books. He scavenged the streets and collected materials and brought them back to his apartment. He lived in a boarding house, which apparently looked like a huge hoard. And when he was sent off, he could no longer take care of himself, and his landlord helped him find a place at the place where his father actually died. And he told his landlord just to keep everything. His landlord was an artist himself, and as he was trying to excavate the apartment, he found these materials and recognized their artistic value and worked really hard to get a show.
Well, okay, here. Well, this is where I sort of have a problem. I understand that the vast volume of art is fascinating, but when you start considering it as art, that brings up some interesting issues, because most of this stuff is incredibly violent torture of children.
Yes. Yes. And oftentimes the adults are dressed and the children are naked.
Yeah. And so I look at it as a sort of, it's an interesting document of a person who might have some psychosocial serious issues. And for that matter, don't destroy it. But when it starts to be talked about or exhibited as art objects, that's a hard sell for me.
Right. And not only art objects, but very expensive art objects at this point.
So they're being sold?
Yes, they have been sold. They're in major museums. Individual collectors have them. And I think there's supposed to be an auction where one is supposed to go for $1.25 million.
Are you kidding me?
Well, they're huge.
I know they're huge.
And they're double-sided, so there you go. Maybe if they were smaller.
But okay, Lisa, what's your take on how these objects should be dealt with? These specific ones, Henry Darger's. I know that's putting you on the spot, but I mean, how do you look at these objects?
I find it really interesting because the Henry Darger's, I have been accused of improperly including them in the book because they're not pornography, they're art. But also for putting them in
what?
The book, because they are art. They are.
I love where people draw lines.
Right. So I've gotten in trouble for having them in the book or for having them in the book because they shouldn't be here, because they're obviously representations of a lot of, as you said, psychosocial problems around sexuality.
But one of the things you do in the book that I thought was helpful is you talk a lot about precedence for this kind of imagery and these kinds of erotic thoughts, that there's a whole erotics of slavery that predates Henry Darger, and that there's a language of white slavery, and there was the whole issue of white slavery panic that had gone. And talk about that for a minute.
Well, first off, there's a whole erotics of slavery that go on as part of the abolition movement, that writing compelling materials about the torture of slavery aroused sentiments in any decent human being so that they would oppose slavery. And that's part of the genre of anti-slavery documents, is a way of arousing people's emotions. And one of the things that Freud said is that his patients had erections in response to Uncle Tom's Cabin, that they found it sexually arousing. So there is that background to it. At the end of the 19th century, they start developing this theory of the white slave trade, that white women were being trafficked for sexual purposes. And this is both in the United States and in Europe. There's all of this concern about white slavery. And it's always
slavery by people of color, races of color, cultures of color.
Well, it depends what you think of as color, because the idea of what is of color changes over time.
Yeah, you're right.
It's not necessarily African Americans. Often it's Eastern Europeans or Southern Europeans.
Or Arabs.
Or Arabs. Or, you know, so it's they might be of color, but it was a different constellation of what color looked like at that moment.
Non-white. They were non-white.
Well, people wouldn't say that Eastern Europeans were non-white. They were. Everyone understood them as white, but that they were a different type of white.
So Darger's work can be put into that kind of context too, though. His obsessions, and they were really violent obsessions, actually comes out of a tradition of those obsessions.
Yes, absolutely. And he saw himself as documenting this horrible phantasm of child slavery that was analogous to white slavery. And he told himself, what I find interesting is he tells himself in this story in various iterations as, you know, a hero, as a journalist, right, as a villain. He sees
there were all these variations on his Darger name, too, that appealed in there, too. It's a very strange thing. And people have interviewed him since then, because you mentioned that somebody went and talked to him.
Someone went and talked. Well, it wasn't since he became famous. People had talked to him before. But by the time he became famous, he was dead. So people have not been able to go back and talk to him about what he meant to do. His books were unknown in his lifetime.
So where do these belong? Do these belong as art objects, in your opinion?
I think all of these belong as art objects.
Interesting.
But
okay.
My vision is very broad. I think that we have burned enough. And that maybe we should make sense of these materials rather than immediately section them off.
Do you think part of the problem is that we don't have a good history of sexuality in the United States?
Yeah, we don't have a good history of sexuality, although it's getting better, and we have a really bad history of pornography because nobody wants to know about the past. You know, people are always happy to say pornography is getting worse, but they are not willing to fund studies to prove it.
So is it just that it's getting more graphic?
I don't know what
and there's
people
more
mean by
is
that.
Is there more of it?
Well, I think they think there's more of it, it's more graphic.
But we don't know the real facts.
But we don't know any facts.
We're going to leave it on there. That was great. This is an amazing book, and there are not many books that I read that constantly makes me sort of challenge my thinking about art and folk art and stuff like that. This is one of them. This is great. My guest tonight has been Lisa Z. Seagull.
Just like the bird.
Yeah. She's professor of history at DePaul University of Chicago. We're talking about her new book. It's really interesting. It's challenging. The People's Porn, A History of Homemade Pornography in America. Lisa, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.